Good afternoon. We're delighted to see you and delighted to welcome Marinette High School students. Would they please stand? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. Students are here with a program sponsored by this court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. The program is called Court with Class. High school students across the state are invited to come and join us for an oral argument. If the students accept the invitation, they are sent materials about this case and may engage in some activities related to the case. They come for oral argument, and ordinarily we have students in the morning and they are here for the noon session. Marinette here for the noon session?
For a good part of it, yes.
Good. During that session, a justice of the court who was assigned for that day will discuss with the students the procedures for taking and then hearing and deciding cases, not the substantive issues. Justice Crooks was our justice today. He tells me that the Marinette group made it for some of that session, so that's good. Let me introduce the court to you all. I'll start with myself. I'm Shirley Abrahamson. I'm the Chief Justice. And to my left is Justice Patrick Crooks, whom you've met. And to his left, Justice Patience Rogensack. And to her left, Justice Michael Gableman. And starting on the far end to my right is Justice Annette Ziegler. Seated next to her is Justice David Prosser. And to my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. With those introductions made, we will now call our last case for today, 09AP 1021, the State of James Shepherd versus Jessica Schleiss. Arguing, we have a number of people arguing. According to our notes, it's J. Lewis Burleson, will argue for 10 minutes. Michael McMurrow, 15 minutes. They are for the estate of James Shepherd, correct? And then 30 minutes, Elaine Shanebrook, arguing for the Schleisses. And then we have Mr. McMurrow in 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Pearlson, you may proceed.
May it please the court. I am attorney Lou Pearlson of the law firm of Michael Best and Friedrich. Appellate's time for argument this afternoon will be shared by attorney Michael McMurrow and myself. I will discuss the estate's right of reimbursement of federal estate tax pursuant to Internal Revenue Code Section 2207B as a result of the inclusion of certain payable on death accounts, as POD accounts, in the gross estate. Attorney McMurrow will discuss the estate's claim for limited equitable apportionment, our contract claim against the Schleiss family, and certain equitable claims presented in our briefs. This appeal is from a decision on motion for summary judgment in favor of the defendants by the Honorable Patrick Farragher of Washington County Circuit Court. The estate has appealed that decision. We are pleased that the court has granted our petition for bypass. The appellant strongly believes that the issues presented in this case will have broad applicability to estates and beneficiaries of various non-testamentary vehicles currently in widespread use in Wisconsin and around the country. I am an estate planner, a trust and estates attorney. I'm not a litigator. However, I think it's important for me to participate in this oral argument today because of the significance of the issues presented in my practice. Historically, several states, including Wisconsin, have applied the principle that the residue of the probate estate bears the burden of the estate tax, both federal and Wisconsin. This principle, however, was established at a time when the vast majority of a decedent's assets passed as probate assets, either by a will or by intestacy. Today, with or without proper planning, often only a very small percentage of the decedent's assets pass through the probate process. Rather, assets transfer via POD accounts, the subject of today's argument, or through joint tenancy, survivorship, marital property, so-called Washington wills, life insurance beneficiary designations, retirement plan designations, and of course, revocable living trusts. Should the beneficiaries of the residue of the probate estate that happens to pass under a decedent's will bear the responsibility to pay all estate taxes and allow those beneficiaries who receive assets through these non-probate vehicles walk away with no estate tax liability?
But the will could affect that, could it not?
The will could, indeed. If the will clearly expresses the testator's intent, the will can override federal law and state law in that regard.
There was no will here.
There's no will here. So there's no testator's intent indicated.
Mr. Carlson, if we were to take the approach that you support, would we have to overrule the First Star Trust Company case?
No, Your Honor, you would not. And Attorney McMorrow will deal with that subject quite directly in his argument.
You don't see us having to overrule any Wisconsin cases?
No, Your Honor.
Do you think you always need a will to know what someone's intent is? How do we know that he didn't intend this?
We don't. But for the federal law, I don't think that's important, because the federal law is clear in certain instances how the estate tax should be apportioned. And that's what I will discuss in my argument.
I'm really surprised, since POD accounts are so common in Wisconsin and probably across the country, that this issue wasn't settled out in federal law, whether it comes under the code.
I as well, Your Honor. And we were surprised when we researched the common law and did not find much in the way of case law. There are, however, three cases that we cite in our brief, one particularly the Burke case, which deals with so-called Totten Trusts, which in effect, you may remember that from law school, the term Totten Trust, which in effect is a POD account. In fact, in our definition in Chapter 705 dealing with POD accounts, a Totten Trust is described and is included. And in the Indiana case, Burke case, the court held that it was included in the estate under 2036 and 2038, and that the reimbursement right under 2207B did apply.
That's it?
That's the extent of... there's a couple other cases dealing with revocable trusts and an Illinois land trust, which again, the courts in those cases, federal circuit court cases, did hold that revocable trusts are included under 2036 and 2038, and thus the reimbursement right provided under 2207B does apply to those cases. Revocable trusts and Illinois land trusts are really very similar to POD accounts. There is a transfer or creation of a POD account. The decedent holds a right, continues the right to possession and enjoyment and the income of the property, and there's a transfer. POD accounts are the same way. It's clear that POD accounts, the owner, the person who set up the account, has the right to the income, possession, enjoyment, the revocability.
All of the control.
All of the control. And the transfer is the establishment of the account and the creation of rights in the POD beneficiary.
Counselor, Mr. Shepard decided that the morning of his death that he thought Justice Rogensack would be a much better beneficiary than his goddaughter, he could have changed the account that day.
Absolutely.
And made anyone
Absolutely.
The beneficiary. And I'm having trouble with your argument because I don't see a transfer to the beneficiary. Can you elaborate on that for me a little bit,
sure.
please?
The transfer is the shifting of rights. If Mr. Shepard had opened up a regular bank account in his sole name, the assets on his death would pass under his will, or in this case, through intestacy. But when he established the account, he shifted the universal rights in those assets away from the probate estate, if that was going to remain
the same.
But he
didn't shift them away from himself.
Pardon?
He didn't shift any rights away from himself.
I am not arguing that. It's a revocable transfer.
Okay, just so I understand, you say that even though the transfer occurred posthumously, it counts as a transfer under the code, right?
Because he set up an account with a bank form that clearly showed what would happen on his death.
Okay. Right.
And that's a shifting of rights. That is what's required under 2036.
If someone sets up a payment on death account and names a beneficiary, does the beneficiary even have to know that that account exists?
No.
Oh, okay.
Nor does if there's a revocable living trust or a life insurance policy that names a beneficiary, those people don't have to have notice of the fact. But there are reimbursement sections under the Internal Revenue Code that deal with that type of situation, even though it's a revocable transfer, Your Honor.
If the beneficiary of the payment on death account doesn't even have to know about it, how is there a transfer before death?
Because rights in this property shift. There's a right that is created at the time the bank form is filled out. And that is indeed a shifting of rights. It's not a transfer in the classical sense with knowledge and irrevocable nature. But the Internal Revenue Code in Code Section 2036 and 2038 clearly provide that this type of asset's includable, and it specifically provides that if the type of asset falls under 2036, that 2207B applies and the reimbursement is applicable.
Oh, what's the a life insurance policy with a beneficiary, not an irrevocable beneficiary, but a life insurance policy beneficiary? How is that taxed? It's included in the estate. How is the estate tax apportioned to it?
There is another code section, 2207, not 2207A or B, 2207, which provides for reimbursement of the estate tax from a life insurance beneficiary.
And is a revocable trust handled separately in a different provision?
An irrevocable life insurance trust, you would hope the insurance proceeds are outside the estate because the insured is not the owner of the policy at the time of the insured's death. So that, if it's done right, should be outside of the estate totally.
But what about a revocable trust, that which can be revoked
mm-hmm.
outside the estate?
The two cases I have cited in our briefs, Your Honor, both say that both 2036 and 2038 apply. And since 2207B provides for reimbursement of estate tax under 2036. It is the same as a POD account.
Counsel.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I'm done. Thank you.
You talked about the ownership of the insured. I thought that under 2026, that the ownership interest has to 2036, excuse me. The ownership interest has to pass during the lifetime in order to fall under 2036.
Mm-hmm. And the creation of a POD account
is a passing of an ownership interest?
Pardon?
Is that a passing of an ownership interest?
If you read Chapter 705, it refers to the person who established the account as the owner. Okay? Mm-hmm. And the owner has full rights,
full control,
of possession.
Full
but
everything.
Again, that's what's contemplated under 2036. Mm-hmm. There's a transfer.
So what ownership interest passes during the lifetime here?
As I say, there's a shifting of rights to the payable on death beneficiary. That if nothing is done by the person who set up the account during lifetime, that property automatically transfers to the POD beneficiary on death.
What rights did Jessica have to these funds while he was still alive? I'm having a disconnect here. You have to help me out with this. Could she withdraw funds?
No, and no rights. But again, 2036 says that during lifetime, the creator of, I'll say, the POD account has full possession, full ownership, full rights to enjoy, and all of the income. That's the same under any 2036 transfer. There is a lifetime transfer. It isn't necessary that rights exist in the particular POD beneficiary other than through the account, the bank account, which says on the happening of the event, the death, it goes to the payable on death beneficiary as opposed to through the probate estate.
So under Justice Rogensack's example, if the day before his death he transfers it to her, who's the transfer to, Jessica or Justice Rogensack? And when did the transfer occur under your theory that a transfer occurred when the account was made?
The transfer of the rights occur when the account is established. The transfer of the property in the account passes upon the death of the owner of the account.
So when you say there's a transfer, what do you mean? When was there a transfer?
The transfer is when the account is open.
So there would be two transfers in that instance.
Right.
But when an account is open, let's say an account is open and there's $1 million in the account. The beneficiary doesn't have to know. The beneficiary can change until the time of death.
Correct.
And the owner of the account can spend every dime.
Absolutely. And that's
how can you say there is a transfer to the beneficiary then?
Well, again, I'm trying to draw an analogy to a revocable living trust situation where clearly a revocable living trust is under 2036 of the code. And there you create a trust. You retain the right to revoke the trust. You retain the right to all of the ownership and enjoyment and income of the trust assets. And the remainder beneficiaries, your family's rights, only really begin at the time of the person's death. Up to that time, it's revocable. The trust is revocable. And the person who sets up the trust is the sole beneficiary. So the transfer occurs at the time the assets are transferred from your own name, let's say, into the name of the revocable living trust, or in this case, into the POD account.
It's a
shifting of rights.
There's a revocable transfer.
It's a
revocable shift of rights.
Indeed. And the respondents would like to say that a a transfer like this only occurs if the transfer is irrevocable, but the case law clearly, the federal case law, clearly indicates that that's not the case.
Chief, and the right is the right to include the POD account in the estate, or what's the right, the value of the POD account in their will or something? What's the right that's being transferred?
It's the right to receive the death, the balance on death directly as opposed through a probate proceeding, which is exactly happened here. If this account were in Mr. Shepherd's name individually, it would go to his heirs through intestacy. Here it went to Jessica.
Thank you, Mr. Pearlson. Mr. McMorrow?
Please, the Honorable Court, I also represent the estate of James F. Shepherd. I'm here to speak today by assignment with respect to the doctrine of limited equitable apportionment. Just stepping back, the estate by way of relief seeks a declaratory judgment that the doctrine of limited equitable apportionment applies to the payable on death account, and that by virtue of this order, the estate is subrogated to the position of the sovereignties and is entitled to collect the funds in its own name. In coming to the conclusion that limited equitable apportionment applies in this case, 9 or 10 precepts apply. The first of which is that in the estate's opinion, the doctrine of limited equitable apportionment already exists in this state. It just has never been so said or expressed. And that is derived from a careful reading of In re Cudahy's will in 1947. The second precept or tenet is a clear understanding of two definitions: what is probate property and what is an expense of administration. The estate asserts that probate property is property which is subject to the jurisdiction of the probate court, that is to say, requires administration under Section 850.101 of the statutes. What is administration? Administration expense are debts, claims, and estate taxes which arise by virtue of the probate estate being calculated. The estate asserts in this case that our able opponents have focused on the doctrine of equitable apportionment alone, which deals with inside property, as it's sometimes referred to, probate property as distinguished from outside property or non-probate property as defined in Chapter 705. The next premise is that the four cases relied on by the respondent, being Coots, Joas, Eline, and Firstar, are all probate property cases, in as much as the property in those cases was subject to the jurisdiction of the court and required a formal order as a condition or administrative process of a condition of termination of title in the decedent and passage thereof to the beneficiary. The only standalone case in Wisconsin is In re Cudahy, decided in 1947, wherein the court scrutinized an inter vivos living trust, a non-probate piece of property. And under circumstances where the general pay-all death tax clause was found by this court to be ambiguous, the court then concluded that this non-probate property was responsible to pay its own share of the tax under circumstances where the testator's intent was ambiguous. And by virtue of that ruling, the estate asserts that the doctrine of burden on the residue was rejected in Cudahy with respect to non-probate property. The next case to evaluate is Eline. Eline is a decision that bears solely on probate property, that is to say, which of the beneficiaries of the estate, inside property, should bear the burden of the estate tax under circumstances where the widow elected against the will. This court, at page 396, I believe, of the opinion, indicated that it was not in a position to legislate with regard to administrative expenses when those administrative expenses included taxes on the probate estate. That rule of law, the burden on the residue rule, was not extended to non-probate property in Eline. As a matter of fact, the standalone decision, being the Cudahy case, wasn't even mentioned in Eline. The same circumstances we find in the Joas case. Joas, a non-testamentary probate property case. We know it's a probate property case because the joint tenancy real estate in Joas was transferred by virtue of a probate court final judgment, which is the equivalent of Section 863.27 of the Wisconsin statutes as we see it today, and that is a formal probate code closing process. And once again, this court made no mention in Joas of the standalone ruling in In re Cudahy. We then look at the Coutts case. Coutts is wholly inapplicable, inasmuch as Coutts deals with the deductibility of federal estate tax when we're reporting inheritance tax. And in that case, dealing solely with a probate assets, concluded that the court would not modify an existing statute on deductibility. That's not what's at issue here. The only other two cases that we can find that bear on these circumstances are Firstar and Bauknecht. Bauknecht is cited in Firstar. Interestingly, in Bauknecht, the issue before the court was whether a marital deduction trust should pay its fair share of the inheritance taxes factually. And Justice Hallows, at the end of the case, indicated that this marital deduction trust, in those days 2056 of the code, federal code, indicated that you had a 50% marital deduction, indicated that that marital deduction trust was to pay its own share of the tax, and if lawyers and clients wanted to do something different, he cited them to Eckert and said draft around it specifically. And it's interesting that what happened in Bauknecht's case was that 50% share of marital property was comprised of not only the $40,000 or so in the marital deduction trust, but that 50% deduction also had property that passed by operation of law. Voila, non-probate property. So Justice Hallow's insight was excellent at that time. Now we come to Firstar. Firstar, Justice Crooks asked if it had to be reversed. Absolutely not. Firstar followed the inside property rule. That is to say, Firstar involved probate property. How do we know? The property in Firstar was under scrutiny. It was derived from a Q-tip trust. Page 4 of Daniel Cooney's will is in the appendix. And that Q-tip trust was created by will, which was admitted to probate. There were claims filed against the Q-tip trust. The Q-tip trust assets were under the scrutiny of the court for 12 years until Mrs. Cooney died. And then her pay-all tax clause provision in her will was scrutinized by the Supreme Court of Wisconsin. And the Supreme Court of Wisconsin in 1995, as this court knows better than I, came to the conclusion that with respect to the state estate taxes, the burden on the residue rule applies. Yes, that's Eline, that's Joe's, but Cudahy was not mentioned in that context. But here in the judgment of the estate is the interesting part. When the court in Firstar applied 2207A, the marital deduction responsibility to pay enacted by the federal government, post Justice Hallow's decision earlier in 1962, this court recited or observed what the Court of Appeals had said in connection with the federal obligation. And the Court of Appeals on page 492 of the Firstar case said this, in essence. Generally speaking, non-probate property pays its own share of the tax unless the will provides otherwise. Someone might say that's dicta. I say it's close to a rule of law. But this court made it, in the judgment of the estate, the rule of law in this state. That is to say, on page 496 and 497, the Supreme Court of Wisconsin authored, I believe, who authored the decision, but analyzed the escape hatch that's available such that 2207A does not apply if the testator makes it absolutely clear to draft around. And what this court said is that non-probate property starts as having its obligation to pay the own tax. But then the court analyzed a crossroads. Some decisions indicate that a general pay-all tax clause will shift that burden. Some decisions do not, specifically footnote 5 of the FirstStar decision. But based on a close analysis of FirstStar, Joas, Eline, and Cudahy, it is the position of the estate of James F. Shepard that the law of limited equitable apportionment currently exists in this state, and that the the very able colleagues against us in this case, but I believe that they focused their argument on apportionment across the board as distinguished from limited equitable apportionment. I should say also that I'm sure the court will look closely at Eline. It's interesting.
Counsel.
Yes, sir.
I'm not sure I'm taking this all in, but why is your argument so important if this is a cut and dried matter, as your co-counsel is saying, in terms of federal law?
Well, it is, Your Honor, because I tried at the onset to avoid all this. And I had a contract drafted with the respondent's clients whereby they agreed to pay or to withhold their share of the tax so as to avoid litigations and questions and implement the law as we saw it. Obviously, we're here a year or so later because there's a controversy, or at least there's some dissension out in the community with regard to the obligation to pay this tax.
What was the consideration for the contract? I missed that.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. The consideration in the estate's view, nominal, however, stands in the form of forbearance. I represent the estate, as you know, and if I would have known that there was going to be a total draining of this account and not honoring the agreement that we had reached, I was in a position to bring an action to seek injunctive relief and the constructive trust that we seek here today. The forbearance was a stand-down position. Please take your 50% and let the rest be for taxes, as we discussed, as is the law. I carefully explained that to the family. This is the law in Wisconsin. Got to set aside the money to pay the tax. It was all set. They drained the account. Coming quickly to Mr. Perlson's argument, a few thoughts that I had here. The Bogren case indicates that the right to change the beneficiary does not affect the application of 2036. And the reason for that in the view of the estate is it is not the creation of a remainder interest that's necessary under 2036. It's the creation or withholding of retained rights. I like to call it PIE, possession, income, enjoyment. And if there's a transfer and you have PIE, as the Germans would say, it's Mach's Nix what the remainder person has, because you have fit within the definition of 2036. And once you're within the definition of 2036, I can't see how 2207B doesn't apply. So that would be my answer there. What did Mr. Shepard give up? He gave up the right by will to transfer the monies in the POD account to an heir. He gave up the right to utilize the intestate statutes in the state of Wisconsin, and he specifically picked a beneficiary. The Doar decision, Seventh Circuit, and unfortunately, Doar is the only case we could find, D-O-E-R-R, on a gift tax situation that defined transfer. And transfer is the giving up of a right.
So if giving up of the right to have the money to go through his estate to the beneficiaries instead of going to Jessica, if that's the right, that would include then this money in the estate for purposes of taxes. It seems to me like under this argument, all non-probate transfers would be includable. And there's no need for some of the other sections.
That's a very good point, Your Honor. And what we have, I believe, in the federal estate tax realm is an overlap. So it could this property could, and I believe it was the Baugrin case again, Seventh Circuit, that indicated property of this description could fit 2036 or 2038. But in this case, 2036 under 2207B is not mutually exclusive. That is to say, all that has to be found is that 2036 applies. And once 2036 applies, the right to reimbursement federally is approved. And it's interesting to note that in the brief by the respondents, they're arguing this is a 2038 case. Well, 2038 requires a transfer too. So there's almost a stipulation. If 2038 applies, says the respondent, the respondents have stipulated that a transfer occurred. As far as the POD ownership interest is concerned, yes, the respondent has an ownership interest. That's all he has to have. He has to retain PI for life. This is a statutory construction case, as I see it. And what we have here is, which is the more specific and which is the more general? 2036 applies because it deals with life estates or defined retention of life estates, whereas 2038 is a general statute which applies to transfers that are subject to change at death. Shifting then quickly to the contract case, and I have 30 seconds at most. We press the contract case for constructive trust. We don't know where this money is. We're looking for equity. The relief requested is that we have a subrogation right after the court finds that limited equitable apportionment makes the respondent responsible on both state and federal estate tax, that we have a subrogation right, that we can press the issue independently, even though some of the tax has not been paid, as I point out in my appendix, and that we can have, hopefully, by virtue of the court's favorable ruling in this case, a constructive trust so the money doesn't go anywhere. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Shane Brooks, representing the Slices.
May it please the court, my name is Elaine Shanebrook from Shanebrook and Falkowski Law Office. With me today is co-counsel attorney James G. Poros of the O'Meara Law Firm. I too am an estate planner. I introduce James and Mary Jo Schleis. Jessica is a college student whose class is presented in irreconcilable conflict for today. I would like to address the first arguments having to do with the issue of the federal tax law. And the one statement that Attorney McMorrow made that I agree with, which may be one of the few that I agree with, is that this is a case of statutory construction. Section 2002 of the Internal Revenue Code requires the estate to pay all of the tax, and the regulations make it very clear that it is for the probate assets and also for the non-probate assets. Within that federal law, there is a federal apportionment in four limited exceptions. Justice Abramson, you had asked about life insurance. It is actually Code Section 2206 that speaks directly to life insurance, and under the federal tax law, there is federal apportionment for life insurance. A second exception is power of appointment property. A second section is for property which would be marital deduction property, which can be exemplified by the marital trust, which was in the First Star case. The fourth one, which is the one centering on today's case, is whether or not the POD account can be fit into Section 2036 and therefore 2207B be a transfer with a retained life estate. 2207B is rather new to the tax code. It was passed in the late 80s. Those are the limited four exceptions. Wisconsin has followed the common law rule that the estate pays the estate tax. There is no Wisconsin statute on apportionment. There are other types of non-probate transfers. There is joint tenancy property for which there is no federal statute on apportionment. There are IRA accounts, retirement accounts, for which there are beneficiary designations. There is no federal statute on apportionment. There are annuity contracts for which beneficiaries may be named. There is no federal statute on apportionment for that. And in Wisconsin, we have marital property agreements that provide for beneficiary designations. There is no apportionment for those. I would like to address the inclusion statutes. And the inclusion statute of Section 2033 is one of many inclusion statutes. And 2036 is one among the various inclusion statutes. So if property is included under Section 2033, there is no right of reimbursement for the estate tax, no right of apportionment. I would like to go through.
Well, I'm trying to find the number now.
Okay.
I didn't understand it. Doesn't that cover everything?
2033 includes the value of all property to the extent of the interest of the decedent at death, basically meaning what they own at the time they die.
Doesn't that include probate property?
It includes probate property. And what I would like to draw the parallel is that the POD and TOD statutes do not change ownership. These are POD and TOD accounts are creatures of Wisconsin statutes. Section 705.032 says a POD account belongs to the original payee during his lifetime. Section 705.26 says a TOD account does not affect ownership until death. And there were so many questions by the justices as to whether a transfer has taken place. And it is the contention of the Schleys that no transfer has taken place.
Well, counsel, Mr. Perlman has said unequivocally, he's an estate planner, and the moment that payment on death account is created, there is a transfer. What is your answer to that?
My statement is that if you chose to make me a beneficiary of your account, what rights do I have? And I feel that I have none, and I too am an estate planner. I have no rights until death. With his argument, if his argument for a transfer were to be so broad, would then that transfer, that construction of Section 2036, then not apply to naming a beneficiary on an annuity? Naming a beneficiary, would it not also apply to a joint account where you've actually put someone else's name during lifetime on the name of the account? Would it not also apply to the IRA beneficiary? And as Justice Bradley was intimating, if the word transfer was to be such a broad connotation that by the act of making a beneficiary, we have had a transfer of the assets, then the imposition of 2207B in the late 80s would have been a major change in the law because it really would have created federal law apportionment for everything for which a beneficiary was named. And then would not one expect, if that were the interpretation to be drawn by 2036, that naming a beneficiary is a transfer, that somewhere in these 50 states there would be a case on an annuity or an IRA or some other pure beneficiary arrangement. And there is none. And if that interpretation of 2036C was correct, that the transfer was such a broad interpretation, wouldn't the tax treatises, CCH, BNA, RIA, would they not also comment that we now have federal apportionment? They don't, because the construction that is being taken by the Shepherd estate is just far too broad. It's a statutory construction case, and it is not this type of account. The POD and TOD account is not what 2036 was looking at.
Counsel, is that what you understood, Mr. Perlson, to suggest that the ownership actually transfers?
I did not suggest that the ownership transferred, but that he was looking for some type of property right or interest that did create a transfer.
I think, to be fair, it seemed that he was very careful to point out, at least to my ears, he was very careful to point out he was not suggesting a transfer of ownership, but a transfer of or a shifting in the comparative rights as to who would take if it went through probate as opposed to an assignment on transfer. I wanted to make sure everyone was on equal footing there.
Yes, and if I stated something to the contrary, then I apologize in my...
I just wanted clarity.
Yes, but the act of... Does the act of naming a beneficiary, is that a transfer of an interest? And I submit as an estate planner that it is not, because to me, in the property sense of the law, if you have an interest in property...
You summed your position up very well by asking the rhetorical question at the beginning of what rights do I have if I am the designated transferee until death?
There are other inclusion.
Are you done answering?
Yes, ma'am.
What does fit under 2036? Give me some examples.
I would give the example of a grantor retained annuity trust, a grantor retained unit trust. These are, I would give the example that is probably most common to all of us is when a parent transfers their home to their child or children and retains a life estate arrangement. Because one of the aspects of 2036 that did not come up in the earlier discussion is that there is a transfer, but there is also then a retention of rights that is either limited to the lifetime or to direct future use and possession. It connotes that something has been given away, so that something less than the whole has been retained. The examples, and as I had indicated in my brief, as a case of statutory construction, one of the best sources of what 2036C would mean to include would be contained in the tax regulations to Section 2036. And in those tax regulations to Section 2036, they connote the examples that I have just detailed.
Could I ask, Lisa Moore played a role in this case at some point?
Lisa Moore played a role in that she, and now we're shifting to actually the third cause of action having to do with the agreement.
Well, I thought she basically advised the court or advised the opposing counsel that there was no obligation of Jessica to pay this money, the tax money.
That is correct. A copy of her October 10 correspondence has been referenced many times by the state's materials.
Is she an estate planner?
She is not an estate planner. I should not say, Your Honor, I'm not certain what her practice focuses on, but she was the court-appointed guardian ad litem. And in the court guardianship process, the Schleys presented the agreement that they had signed and asked, and they were the letter from Attorney Moore speaks for itself.
It kind of leaves me breathless. Payment on death accounts is certainly not just a Wisconsin thing, is it?
That is correct.
It's probably all over the country, isn't it?
Yes.
Are you telling us that the Wisconsin Supreme Court is going to decide this case for the entire United States of America?
No, sir. I am saying that there is not a case from another jurisdiction that deals with a payable on death arrangement. And my intimation is that if the estate's construction of 2036C were correct, one would have expected that there would be an articulation of that philosophy in the tax literature and the tax treatises that exist. But that is not the case. And there is no case on a pure beneficiary arrangement. The estate noted that I cited no cases that say a POD account is not a 2036C transfer. However, they have no case to say that it is. And this is where, as I would refer to other cases, statutes that for our inclusion statutes under the estate tax law, there are inclusion statutes for revocable transfers and transfers taking effect at death, 2037 and 2038. If assets are included under 2037 or 2038, they are not subject to the federal rules of apportionment. Likewise, annuities are subject to a separate inclusion statute, Section 2039, but there is no federal rule for apportionment for those. So yes, assets are treated differently depending upon how they are structured, because the federal apportionment rules are limited to those four: life estate, power of appointment, marital deduction trust, and also the 2036C. This would be a huge change in Wisconsin law, too, as I would like. But before addressing the Wisconsin law, I also wish to say that Section 2040 is an inclusion case on joint property. Joint property passes without probate, but there is no federal rule for apportionment on joint property. And in fact, the Joaz case, which was decided in Wisconsin in 1962, dealt with joint tenancy property. And while Attorney McMorrow talked about whether it was in the subject of probate jurisdiction or not, there was a time in our history when joint property appeared on inventories, but it did not make it probate property. The Joaz decision addressed estate tax for a non-probate asset and very clearly said that the federal estate tax on non-probate property is to be paid out of the residue of the estate. What the Shepherd estate is asking this court to do is to make a huge change in Wisconsin law. Justice Crooks, you had asked the question as to whether First Star would need to be overruled. Specifically, on parts of First Star, it dealt with one of the exceptions for federal apportionment because it had a marital deduction trust, which is one of those four exceptions. Now, all of the cases that have dealt with apportionment in Wisconsin, some of them are under the Wisconsin inheritance tax law, some are under the estate tax law, and they all come from different factual circumstances. When you have cases that come from different factual circumstances, you have certain themes or holdings in the law that start to be echoed and repeated. And as those themes are repeated, they become a principle of Wisconsin law. What the estate is asking you to do is to reverse all of those longstanding principles of law. Those principles are that tax obligation should be paid from the place where the law places the obligation. And
first
secondly,
of all, let me interrupt you for a minute. How do you respond to your opposing counsel's argument that it's the Cudahy case that we should be looking at, and it's the Cudahy case that would give us the guidance we need to decide this matter?
The case was an inheritance tax case, and in that there was a will that said that all the inheritance taxes should be paid. There were probate assets and there was a separate trust with assets. So this court had to deal with one of those perennial questions as to what was the intent of the person, because you had conflicting clauses. And the principle of the law was that, as echoed in First Star, that if it isn't really clear, we're going to let the tax obligation fall where the law placed it. And in that case, it was an inheritance tax case, and the obligation to pay inheritance tax fell on the beneficiary, as opposed to the estate tax, where the estate tax obligation is a debt of the estate. And I believe that the estate in their brief has taken certain inheritance tax cases where the inheritance tax law places the obligation to pay the inheritance tax on the recipient as a notion that Jessica should pay tax. But we are in an estate tax case, and the estate tax are the issues today.
And the inheritance tax law is basically law that's been changed, because we've changed how we deal with taxes upon death in Wisconsin, correct? Because I know when I was in law school, the general rule was that the federal government put a tax on the right to give, and the state of Wisconsin put a tax on the right to receive, unless they were altered by will or some other mechanism.
That
but now correct. Both place a tax on the right to give, and then you go from there. Is that correct?
That is correct. The inheritance tax law ended in 1991, and actually Wisconsin no longer has an estate tax law for people who are dying at this time.
In Cudahy, the intent was ambiguous, right?
Yes.
What role does that play versus here, where I go back to the first question I asked? Do you need a will in order to express your intent? Is there ambiguous intent here?
There are rules of default that apply when the expression of intent is lacking, and in when the rule is that the estate pays the estate tax. The principle of law in Cudahy that I believe that is an applicable principle is that the court didn't deviate from the holding that the tax liability, who should pay the tax, went to the person on whom the state of Wisconsin imposed the obligation to pay it, the recipient. And therefore, the recipient trust, which was the non-probate element, paid the estate tax, or excuse me, paid the inheritance tax in that case. One of those, the second of those principles is not to shift that obligation unless it was clear by intent. And the prevailing rule, the dominant rule in Wisconsin, is that the estate pays the estate tax. We have no will. We have no expression of Mr. Shepherd's intent. The only thing that we know that Mr. Shepherd wanted to do was that he wanted to name Jessica as beneficiaries of those accounts.
If you apportioned, what amount would Jessica pay? Approximately.
The estate is a $12 million estate based upon what Attorney McMorrow had advised in his filing. Among the assets of the estate are various closely held business interests, so whether those valuations are valuations accepted by the IRS, I do not personally know yet. So there could be changes to the numbers to then alter the skew of that. At the time that Mr. Shepherd died, the estate tax exemption was then $2 million, and the applicable largest rate, I believe, was 45% in effect in calendar year for a death in calendar year 2007. Not sure if I should address the 2036 issues or the apportionment issues. I will continue.
It's the dealer's choice.
Thank you. Because as Justice Crooks had asked about the Eline case, the First Star case, the First Star case held without the pay all the taxes, without the boilerplate clause in the will, the federal estate tax obligation would have fallen on the marital trust. And this court determined the marital trust should pay the tax. And that's holding fast to the principle that we're going to leave the tax burden where it was initially unless it is very clear that it should be shifted. The other aspect of the First Star decision that is very important to this case and what I would say is precedent setting is that even in view of the fact that the marital trust was one of the four exceptions to the federal law on apportionment, this court determined that the estate needed to pay all of the estate tax, the Wisconsin estate tax, so that I believe that the appeal by the estate is both as to apportionment of federal and state estate taxes, but I would submit that First Star is binding on the conclusion in that result. With respect to Joaz, which was decided in 1962, Wisconsin courts held that the law had placed the burden of paying the federal estate tax on joint property on the residual of the probate estate. I do not know how this, if this court is to follow and abide precedent, Joaz's precedent for in favor of Jessica Schleis, that the estate tax is an obligation of the probate estate, to rule otherwise would be a reversal of Joaz. In Eline, where the equities had to do with a spouse, there's no one closer to a decedent person by relationship than their spouse. And the question on an election out of the share was, should the estate tax come out first, and then do we take the elective share on one-third of the net, or do we let the spouse take her third first, and then compute the balance for the elective, then take the estate tax out of the balance. And even when the equities might have favored the spouse, the ruling of the court was not to apportion. The tax was a debt of the estate. It came out first, and then the one-third elective share was applied. Justice Curry and other, and it, there have been other repetition of this quotation of his, that it would be felt that it would be unwarranted judicial legislation for the court to attempt to apportion the impact of the federal estate tax as Kentucky and Ohio. In other cases dealing with apportionment, there have been arguments made referring to what other states have or have not done. The Wisconsin courts, in a long, consistent set of rulings, have always held that the tax obligation should be paid by the person on whom the law places it unless there was a clear shifting otherwise. And Wisconsin is not alone in not having apportionment. There are many states that do have apportionment. And Justice Abramson, you had asked a question about this settling out to some extent. Part of the answer to your question would be that there are several states that have passed the uniform law on estate tax apportionment. And therefore, many states do have express legislation that deals with how you deal with these issues. Wisconsin is not among the states that has chosen as part of its public policy to do so. And I would submit that doing so is a legislative matter. The Uniform Act is about 30 pages long. It deals with a number of issues. And
where does it put PODs?
Excuse me?
How does it treat PODs?
I believe that they would be included in apportionment, I believe.
Let me ask just a sort of hypothetical question. Assuming you're right on the law, the remainder of the estate is so small that you couldn't really pay the estate tax on the total. What happens then?
It's an excellent question. If the estate is too small to pay all the estate tax, then the recipient beneficiary is liable. There are special lien rights that the IRS has, and it is clear that if the estate were insolvent, that Ms. Schleis would then, if the estate were zero and this account were the only asset, it is very clear that she would owe her share of estate tax on it through the lien rights.
And is that in federal law somewhere?
Yes.
In some section?
Yes.
You don't happen to know what that
is? I want to say 6324, but I hope that I am not incorrect.
And the fact that such a section exists, does that imply anything?
It would imply that if there is a probate estate, the probate estate is supposed to pay the estate tax.
Follows the rule that the feds take it first.
Yes. And state law is similar. Most of the laws are designed to guarantee collection of the ultimate tax. And even
because otherwise you could too easily defeat the federal tax system.
I would like to reserve my remaining minutes to address the so-called agreement that Mr. and Mrs. Schleis signed. It appears on the appellant's and in the appendix at page 100, or it's a document, APP 100. And when you review that, I would ask that you review that looking to see that you will not find Jessica Schleis's name mentioned in this purported agreement. She was not a party to the agreement. And as I read the summary of today's case that was made available, there is some intimation in the facts that this agreement somehow affected her. It was the trial court holding that the agreement did not have bearing on the case. She is not mentioned. She is not a party. At the time that this agreement was signed, her parents had not been appointed her guardian. While there is withholding and special measures for withholding for income tax, there is no such thing as a withholding agreement as it pertains to estate tax, nor there is there a required tax. And I would encourage that this court also find, as the trial court did, that as a matter of law, that it has no bearing in this based upon construction of the agreement and look at the plain meaning of the agreement.
Your opposing counsel sort of says the very fact that this sign thing existed kind of duped me into not filing an injunction for constructive trust.
The attorney McMorrow was aware by virtue of Lisa Moore's communication on October 10 of 2007. The important dates. Mr. Shepard died in July 2nd of 2007. The agreement was signed the following August 31st. Lisa Moore advised that it was not binding on Jessica. She did not owe tax on October 10th. And this suit was not initiated until more than a year later, on October 14th of 2008. That agreement to be construed would have need to be construed as being on part of Jessica, who is not a party to the case. And if you are at that part of the case, it also presumes that you would then have agreed that Jessica was not liable for the tax. So in essence, the estate is asking the court to enforce that as a promise by the parents to pay a tax that their daughter never owed in the first place.
Counsel, let me ask you something that I thought was at least interesting and perhaps a little curious. My understanding is that when the money was withdrawn from the account for Jessica, that there was 5 cents left in the account. What was the significance of the 5 cents? If I'm correct, that's the amount left.
Okay. I think that the significance of the 5 cents is that there may have been a clerical issue as to the interest or the amount that was withdrawn. And Jessica was the named beneficiary. Her parents were appointed her guardian, and they had every right. There was nothing inappropriate from them taking the monies from the account of Mr. Shepherd and redepositing them to another account on behalf of their daughter that would earn interest and be invested. In fact, I think one would argue that that was their duty as her guardians to take possession of that money and invest it.
So the 5 cents wasn't to keep the account open or something like that?
I don't think there was no motive. I don't know if it was a banking issue or what.
I just thought it was something.
But I know the estate has the 5 cents, so someday we'll have to ask for that.
Don't worry about that.
I ask that the court, in its construction of the statute, look at the statutes of inclusion and note that there are many statutes of inclusion for estate tax. The treatment of a POD account is not one within the scope of 2036. I have stated in my brief the estate needs to make that argument because without that argument, without it fitting in 2036, the federal rules of apportionment and the contribution are not going to apply. And that is why they're trying to fit the square peg into the proverbial round hole. If it were treated as a revocable transfer, if it was treated as a transfer to take effect at death, or my position that it is property that is owned by the decedent, none of the rights of reimbursement apply.
Don't you think it's fair and equitable to, in this estate, to have each of the beneficiaries pay a fair share?
In the estate planning arena, what is fair for a person is very hard to make a categorical statement because each individual person has a right to determine how they wish to divide their estate. Without the expression in a will, had Mr. Shepherd written a will, it's possible that Jessica Schleiss could have been his residual beneficiary because of the close familial relationship, but she is not in the line of next of kin. But does this, how, in a case where there's a total void of what Mr. Shepherd articulated, how can we begin to say what was fair or not fair? Were this a bequest in his will, the bequest would have been paid in full without apportionment of the estate tax because the residue of the estate would have paid the estate tax. My red light is on.
Thank you
for your attention.
Mr. McMorrow.
Speaking first to the 2236-2207B argument, new rights and obligations attached to the funds and these securities once Jessica Schleiss was named the POD beneficiary. Specifically, if Jessica Schleiss survived and James Shepherd did not change the beneficiary, she did take title to the property free from debt.
Counselor, what about if she died before he did? She doesn't have anything, does she?
Well, under these circumstances, she would not under Chapter 705 because she doesn't take under chapter another chapter of the statute.
Right, so this would just become part of the residue of the state then.
That's correct. But though state law does not apply, the estate has asserted that she did have a remainder interest, which was a conditionally vested remainder interest. Although this remainder interest is not necessary, it was conditionally vested on two things. She had to survive, and Jim Shepard did not have to change his beneficiary, and it was vested because there was a certainty. All Shepard had to do was die, and it was vested. Now, I know that this is not part of the record, but I did, was furnished with Jeffrey N. Pennell, P-E-N-N-E-L's apportionment of death taxes publication from the American College of Trust and Estate Council in 1992. And my reading of this document indicates that 96% of the jurisdictions in this country cause non-probate property, outside property, to pay its own share of the tax. And in Mr. Pennell's analysis as to Wisconsin, quote, a state apportionment tax outside the probate estate, unquote, no authority. Of course, the estate takes issue with Mr. Pennell, notwithstanding he's the expert. The authority, once again, is Cudahy. Cudahy gives us the rule, non-probate property. Justice Ziegler, the intent is ambiguous, just as it is in an interstate situation. And under those situations, Justice Rector indicated, when we don't know, then the burden on the residue rule does not apply, and each asset, the non-probate asset, the living trust, the inter vivos trust, in that case, Cudahy case, was required to pay its own share. With respect to
McMorrow.
Yes, sir.
Justice Crooks asked a question about the Cudahy case to your opposing counsel and said it was simply different. It's inheritance tax versus estate tax. Your response to that?
Well, looking at the Cudahy case, that case started as both an estate tax and an inheritance tax liability case. And the Supreme Court of Wisconsin decided only the inheritance tax case, with Justice Rector saying, I can't do anything right now on the estate tax because there's nothing before me indicating what the estate tax was. So he started analyzing the estate tax. That's a fair question, but he couldn't finish. But in the end analysis, he says the words that if the intent is ambiguous, then the general rule is that non-probate property pays its own share of the tax. And he had the opportunity to follow the burden on the residue rule, or the court did, not just Justice Rector, but they didn't. They could have easily solved Cudahy by implementing the burden on the residue rule as to non-probate property, and they didn't. And that's why I argue before this court that the only standalone case that controls this matter is Cudahy. It is the only non-probate case.
Your opposing counsel's argument to that is that the burden remained where the law had placed it, because that was an inheritance tax case, and the presumption is that the person who gets the gift, the recipient, has the burden, unless that burden is clearly shifted. So an inheritance tax case at that time, is her argument, is quite different from an estate tax case today, where the burden is presumed to be on the giver, not the recipient. How do you respond to that?
I relied, yes, Your Honor, very good question. I struggled with that one. And I relied on Justice Hallows in his final last two paragraphs of the case in Bauknecht, where he says the words, if you want to shift the burden on this marital property to inheritance or estate taxes, you better do so specifically by will, that a general payout tax clause is insufficient, and he cites the lawyers in the state to Eckert as the foundation for the inclusion in his analysis, oblique as it is, to estate taxes as well as inheritance taxes.
Thank you.
Yes. With regard to Joas, I submit respectfully that the opposing counsel misreads Joas. It's clearly a probate property case, nonetheless non-testamentary. But if one wanted to look for legislative intent anywhere in this whole process and focusing specifically on joint tenancy property, there is a probate procedure in the code, summary procedures under Chapter 867. And in 867, this is what the legislature did with regard to joint property. They permitted a process whereby you can submit to the Register of Deeds office an application to transfer joint held real estate or mortgages or interest in land contracts. But there's two provisos. One is it's still an administrative case because you have to file that application with the clerk of the court of the residence of the decedent. But more instructive of what the legislature was thinking, stating in paragraph 4 of 867.045 as follows, quote, this application shall not constitute evidence of payment of any death tax which may be due, the payment for which shall remain the obligation of the surviving joint tenant. There you have it. There's the legislature reading Joe's and saying if we're going to have an administrative transfer, the person that makes that transfer pays the tax on that property.
Says it remains liable.
It remains liable. Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you, Counsel.
The closest I could find to any expression of legislative intent in this analysis.
Thank you. Your time is up.
Oh, thank you very much, members of the court.
Thank you, Mr. McMorrow. Thank you, Mr. Pearlson.
May I ask my question?
Yes, of course. Pardon me?
Whose chart was that?
The same documents as you have at your desk in that little sheet. It's a repeat of the statutes, right?
2056.
Yeah. And whoever owns it can take it. Since no reference was made to it, and I didn't ask about it since no one had made a reference, and I assume you that both counsel knew what that was about. You knew what that chart was.
I did not know that it was going to appear until this morning, but it's...
You don't have any objection for us reading the statute. All right. Just checking. That concludes our hearing in 09 APL 1021, State of James F. Shepherd versus Jessica Schleiss. The court is in recess until our next session on the February calendar, which I think is February 23. The court will meet in the conference room at 3:15.